All right, let's see. So transition just a little bit here. I'm breeding crickets. How's that for a transition? I am breeding crickets right now because a couple of months ago we caught a tree frog in our front yard. And it was such a cool animal that we decided to start to invest in long-term sustainable care for this young frog named Gandalf. We found out later it's a girl. Gandalf the girl. Gandalf the gray. It's a gray tree frog, but that's beside the point. And so anyways, we started catching crickets in the backyard because they're 10 for a dollar at the pet store, and who wants to do that? So we decided to start catching crickets, and then we started to look online and realized that breeding crickets is like a thing. And this is how our family works. We like to save money. We like to experiment with interesting things. And so we caught like 50 crickets, and I did my research, and one of the things that you learn about crickets is all you have to do is create a basic atmosphere with a few elements, and they will do the rest. So you put them in like a Rubbermaid bin, and you put some vegetables in there, or some a potato or a cut up apple, and a little water, and then a dish of dirt off to the side to lay eggs. And that's it. And some heat. Get a lamp. Give them some heat. And they'll chirp like crazy. And all you do is just let them go, and before you know it, 50 crickets turns into 500. So we are in the midst of that, and we have now eggs that have been laid, and we are waiting to see what happens. But I was shocked at how easy this whole process actually is if you get the right elements in place. So we're talking for the next 3 weeks about this kind of theme of understanding what it means to truly share life in community with one another. And what that looks like for us as a church, we're leaning into a new season where we are encouraging people to think really deeply about what it means to be in community with one another, how that can be so transformational, and what that looks like. And one of the primary ways that we do that is through what we call missional communities. So we invite people to get involved in smaller communities that are maybe bigger than a typical small group, if you've heard of that in a church before, but maybe the size of a small extended family kind of a thing, that share in certain practices to be able to do what Jesus has called us to do, which is to love God better and to love others better. Quite simple. But the thing is that we find that it's amazing what can happen if there's just a couple simple elements that get put in place. That life begins to emerge. And yes, don't take the metaphor too far, because we started by talking about cricket sex, and now we're talking about missional communities. But when you have the right elements in place, it's amazing how life can emerge. Now you guys are all distracted. Come on. I'm just going to move. I'm not going to engage right now with you, Ken. So anyways, we're going to talk about three practices that we want to just put in place and that are crucial to be in place when we share life together. And when some of these practices and emphases are happening, life begins to emerge naturally. It's not hard work once you get the right elements in place. And so this understanding will hopefully end up propelling us to deeper sense of community with one another, practices that you look back on and you say, man, because I am engaged in these practices that we see in the scriptures and that we see about helping real relationships form that go a little bit deeper, I am all of a sudden able to grow in my faith in a deeper way. I'm looking out at the world with a more open and generous heart. I'm learning how to serve and be humble and let people serve me. And all of these things are starting to fall into place. So it's crucial that we learn some basic practices. However, it has to start within us. Dietrich Bonhoeffer actually... Oh, and thanks to Allison. She's making some graphics for us now. So using her gifts. I appreciate you putting together some little things for us to make our themes more beautiful all of a sudden. Dietrich Bonhoeffer has a book called Life Together. We won't go into his whole story, but he was a German theologian who was maybe the most influential writer of his time and generation on discipleship and community, okay? And Dietrich Bonhoeffer made this one quote, and he said, "The person who loves their dream of community will destroy community. If you're in love with your dream of what community is, you can actually destroy it. But the person who loves those around them will actually create community. Significant difference. We have a vision as a church of what we think we could look like and what it would be to be healthy. If we fall so in love with that vision that we fail to be able to love the person in front of us, then we will destroy our community. So first and foremost is the willingness to love, which is a willingness to lay down our lives for another. So we can have all these great dreams, but if we're not willing to do the dirty work of actually loving people, it doesn't get anywhere. So that is crucial. Before we talk about any practices, it is absolutely crucial that we understand that the dream is not nearly as important or beneficial as the reality. So we choose to go practical and not theoretical for these weeks. That's why we're talking about meals this morning. Okay? And why we're talking about how it's important to get lots of people around the table. I want you to take a look at this Christmas commercial from an airline for just a minute and just enjoy this simple storyline here. It's a cool little commercial, isn't it? This idea of having to have all the seats at the table full before the real meal can actually be accessed. This idea that I think is true in more of a transcendent way than just what we see on here, that when we get a number of perspectives and experiences and backgrounds and life sitting together, something gets unlocked. Something happens that's not able to be accessed any other way sometimes. Maybe that's why when we look at the scriptures, we see meals everywhere. You absolutely can't escape them. Meals seem to be like the primary motif in the Jesus narrative. Either he was hungry all the time, or he thought meals held real power. One of these two things. Jesus, he taught that the kingdom of God is like a banquet. He attended dinners with Pharisees and other religious leaders who were kind of the upper echelon of society. He told stories that ended with a celebration of killing the fatted calf, which was like this world-class barbecue. He fed 5,000 people, massive picnic. He invited himself over to Zacchaeus' house where he ate with sinners and tax collectors, the lowest echelon of society. He went to the home of his friends Mary and Martha's house. And there was some squabbling over responsibility over preparing a meal. His critics accused him of being a glutton. Even after his resurrection, the disciples tell a story about Jesus cooking them fish for breakfast on the beach. And then how two people recognized Jesus when he began to share a meal with them after he walked along the Emmaus Road with them, where they were not able to see him fully. It wasn't until the meal. For Jesus, life happens around a table. Lessons are taught around a table. Relationships are secured around a table. God is revealed around a table. So it's no surprise that what we see in the early church and in the book of Acts is a story that involves a table. We're given this large list of what the early church looked like and what some of their core practices are. And in Acts 2, verse 46, we're told that every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts, and they broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. Although every translation that you find is different, which is interesting, right? And day by day, the ESV, English Standard, so New Living, we use frequently, English Standard every now and then. Common English is a great translation, but all of these translate this verse differently. You see, gladness comes up every time. That's consistent, right? Look at that last sentence. They received their food with glad and generous hearts. Every day they met together in the temple and ate in their homes, they shared food with gladness and simplicity. It's really, really interesting that as you look at different translations, everybody has a little bit of a challenge of how to deal with this word, of how they shared their meal, how they ate. So we're going to take a look at it just for a second because it's worth it and it's fun. We like working with this stuff and getting geeky a little bit here. So the word first for heart is cardio. This is where we get the word cardio from, right? You know, go out for a cardio workout. The heart in antiquity meant the same, had the same double connotations as it does now. So the heart was seen, because it pumped the blood and controlled circulation, it was seen as the center of the body, but it was also seen as the center of the soul, the center of the spirit, the deepest place within you. So it was the physical center of your body, and it was the spiritual center of your body at the same time. This is why, you know, in Matthew 5, 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. You know, blessed are the people who at their very core, at their inmost places, are seeking goodness and have a purity of focus. Blessed are those people, that's the pure in heart. At the deepest places, they are real and true. So the heart represents the deepest place within them. So something is happening at the deepest place within them that we're learning about here in this early church. So let's get to this word that is sincere, generous heart. I love the phrase generous heartedness, by the way. So we're going to kind of dwell on that one. But the word for this sincerity, let's say, since that's on the top, is called aphelotes. You want to say that? Aphelotes? Yeah, it gives you something fun so you don't just sit there passively. All right, so now that you said it, you have to think about what it means. So aphelotes is actually a compound word. We're not going to get into it too much. It's only found one place in the Bible, right here. And so what it is, aphe, it sounds like alpha and omega, right? So it's about single, it's about one, it's about beginning, okay? So there's a singular focus that is a part of this word. It means that there's a single-minded, some people say that this word could be translated as single-minded, but there's a single-minded focus, and the second part of the word, phelos, gets put together, and phelos is this weird, weird word that isn't on its own in the Bible at all, because it's this strange word that has a picture with it about stubbing your toe, okay? And the way the word is kind of worked out is a negative version of it. So it's a removal of something that might stub your toe. Profound, right? Yes. So what the word image is taking away something that might trip somebody up. Taking away something, it's a smoothing of the path in front of you. It's looking where there might be roots, and it's chopping them off, and it's looking where there might be stones, and it's picking them up. And so this whole idea is of having a heart that at their very core, there was a single-minded focus of smoothing the path in front of them. And that was the attitude with which they shared meals with one another. I find that fascinating, because I think that they were starting to get to what the power of a Jesus meal really was. It was removing. What meals do is they remove sources of friction. They smooth the paths. Eating together was clearing the way for meaningful movement with one another to take place. Cool, right? Maybe you don't think so. You're allowed to disagree. This is the kind of heart behind hospitality, though. This is the kind of heart that comes through in the Jesus meal. This is the gracious-heartedness, the generous-heartedness that we see in Jesus. It breaks down walls. It begins when you sit down and all of a sudden the table is flat you start to see that certain things that might trip us up, certain things that we might use to separate one another, become less important. They get smoothed over. Marcus Borg talks about how significant this concept was in the New Testament. He's a theologian. He says sharing a meal with somebody had a significance in Jesus' social world that's difficult for us to imagine. It was not a casual act, as it can be in the modern world. In a general way, sharing a meal represented mutual acceptance. Pharisees and others would not eat with somebody who was impure, and no decent person would share a meal with an outcast. The meal was a microcosm of the social system. It's still like that a little bit, you know. Social systems still function in this way. People don't invite others to dinner if they don't deem them worthy of friendship, usually. Often they won't invite them if they're in a different socioeconomic bracket sometimes. It makes them feel uncomfortable if someone is from an unfamiliar culture, or if the host family isn't sure if this person's really deserving of my hospitality. A generous heart does not use that system. A generous heart has at its core a singular focus of making the path to love, to relationship, and to Jesus clear. A generous heart in the way of Jesus knows that there's enough room at the table, and that it's often at the table where assumptions and generalizations are broken down. So Jesus eats with all sorts of people, and he enacts a new social system. The whole reason that Marcus Borg talked about that was the fact that Jesus goes into a world where there's a social system, and he changes and starts a new one. Starts a new social system, a new reality for people. I think we can even hear the smoothing heart of Jesus revealed in the unique statement that he made in his final meals with his disciples in Luke 22. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." I love the way Eugene Peterson renders it in the Message translation. "You've no idea how much I've looked forward to eating with you. You've got no clue how much I've been looking forward to being with you around this table." What if that generous hearted spirit spills over beyond the walls and into a way of life that touches other people? What if when people are with us, they feel that sense? What if every time someone's with you, they feel the sense that you are saying, you have no idea how much I've desired to share this meal with you. You've no idea how good it is to see you, to be with you. I have eagerly desired to have this friendship. What if that was the feel that people got? What if the generous heartedness of someone's experience with every single one of us in this room is that when they were with us, they felt like we eagerly desired to be in their presence? What if that's the impact that we had on the world around us? Meals are just a starting point for that, but they are a starting point. Henry Nouwen says, "Isn't a meal together the most beautiful expression of our desire to be given to each other in brokenness? The table, the food, the drinks, the words, the stories, are they not the most intimate ways in which we do not only express the desire to give our lives to each other, but also to do this in actuality? When we eat together, we are vulnerable to one another. Around the table, we can't wear weapons of any sort. Eating from the same bread and drinking from the same cup call us to live in unity and peace. A really peaceful and joyful meal together belongs to the greatest moments in life." That's from a book called Life of the Beloved. People are catching on to this. In Israel right now, an Israeli cafe offers a 50% discount to tables where an Israeli and a Palestinian will sit together and share a meal. 50% off. Or in South Africa, when the Koinonia South African movement brought together courageous black and white citizens in meal groups to counter apartheid. That's what eating with a generous heart looks like, I think. A number of years ago, a guy became part of our church who was pretty disconnected from the world. He's moved away since. But he dealt with a number of challenges. He'd been through a lot of pain in his life. He'd been homeless, he'd been mistreated, he had no family, trail of broken relationships. But he had an interest in cooking. And he got a part of our church, and he became part of our missional community. And he's really good at making good food. So he began sharing meals with us weekly, and then one week, we decided, you know what? Let's give you a bunch of money and tell you to go out and get some really good quality food. Sushi grade. And then bring it back. Why don't you teach us how to make sushi? And so he did. There might be a couple of you who were in that room at the time. And we sat there, and he taught us how to make sushi. And he was the one who had been kind of the outsider, the one without connection. And he was the one teaching us all of a sudden. And the path got smooth. And he felt valued. And he was. He was incredibly valuable. He always had been. But this allowed him to see the beauty of his role in the community as we shared a meal and laughed together in a small way. It was one of the most empowered and confident moments that I got to see in this young man's life. Things get turned upside down around the table. The social patterns and the love and all of these different levels that we have often get reversed. So we eat with glad and sincere hearts. And the path between us gets smoother. Meals are a part of building God's kingdom. Now there's one more thing that needs to be established, I think, as we think about this. We cannot sustain a life of generous heartedness that truly leads to transformation if we have not sat at the table with God to understand the depth of his love. If you've ever heard the phrase, my cup runneth over, which I think many of you have, or my cup runs over, the original phrase that that's coming from comes from the Psalms in Psalm 23, a powerful psalm where David is writing that the Lord is my shepherd. And David equates his life as a shepherd and his own experience, and he places himself in the role of a sheep, and he looks at the shepherd. But he tells this story, and there's different perspectives on if he keeps the role of the sheep the whole time or if he kind of transitions out of that late in the psalm. But at one point, he talks about how the shepherd prepares a meal for him, even in the presence of his enemies. He brings peace. And he says this phrase, he says, and my cup runs over. Now we look at that, and rightly so, understand that to be a phrase of blessing, right? I have more than I need. My cup runs over. But it was actually a social reality in the time of David. And so when you would have someone over for dinner, and you would set the table, and you would pour the wine, you would enjoy the company, but often in a high hospitality culture, people hang around for like quite a while after dinner. And that's welcome, but it can become difficult in certain cultures to know when to tell someone, it's time to go. Please clear the table. You know, maybe some of you have had this experience at a restaurant where you're having a great conversation and your cup of water runs out and you've already paid your bill and the water's just not getting refilled, right? Subtle hint. And so what would happen is you would continue to fill this cup of wine, and when it would get near the end, or when it would get empty, if the host would choose not to refill your cup, it would be a subtle hint, it's time to go. But there was a practice that if the host was enjoying the presence and the company of the person who was the guest so much, they would symbolically act that out by not just pouring the cup full, but continuing to pour so that the cup spilled onto the table. So we think that that makes a mess. But what it was in this time is it was this beautiful glimpse of hospitality, of saying, I deeply desire to share this meal with you. And I love that. And so David equates that to his relationship with God, sitting at a table, and said, God is pouring the wine, and he keeps pouring until it spills over onto the table. And that's how much he longs to be with me. That's the generous heartedness that I get from God. That's how I feel, knowing that I am welcomed at the table with the Lord. If we have that kind of a depth of understanding of the love of God, how much can we then extend that kind of generous heartedness to the people that we engage with? How much can we have that well of the Spirit within us that we say, I eagerly desire to share this meal with you? Now, granted, there might be times where you say, I really desire to share this meal and it was great, but my kids have got to go to bed. And that's fair. But the mentality behind it is significant. God is delighted to have you with him. You have no idea how much he's been looking forward to sitting down at the table with you. For us to pass on our experience of God's delight to one another is a powerful, powerful opportunity. We don't want to miss that. Walls fall down when we sit around the table. Old rules don't apply anymore. Jesus gets delighted, and he passes that on so that you can have a generous heart toward one another. Now, obviously, it's possible to eat in a different spirit, yeah? I'll be honest. From time to time, I partake in the 4 for $4 at Wendy's. And when I do that, my goals are quite clear. My goal when I do a 4 for $4 at Wendy's, this is a good deal. It's a good deal, let's be honest. Is to get in and get out with the least amount of work and the least amount of cost to myself possible. The goal is speed and efficiency. It's always a working lunch. It's just never with anybody else when I do that. It's coming in, I'm either drive-through or I've got my books out right beside me at the table as I'm eating. And that we can enter into that kind of a world where the heartedness is not generous, where the goal is to be efficient. And I'm not just talking about eating. I'm talking about an entire attitude of life. But then if we compare and contrast that with Thanksgiving morning, where people spend time and energy creating something, they put their resources into it, they put their heart into it, and sitting around the table is actually the central part of the activity. The community is the focus. So I guess the challenge is, what kind of heart do you want to have? And how can that be expressed? Do you want a Wendy's heart or a Thanksgiving heart? And I would argue or suggest that the Jesus way is the Thanksgiving heart. And so I want to encourage you with that. And that's what we long to see happen in our missional communities. One of the things that as we launch more at the end of this month, and as we start to help you understand what the core, and as we kind of tweak how we do them right now, many of you have no idea and have never been a part of one. A common shared meal is one of the central elements of what our desire for our missional communities are. Because what we've seen the power that that can hold and how it can break things down and lead to deeper relationships where strangers become friends quite quickly. Some of you know that because some of you were strangers and you've shared a few meals or a coffee or sat down at a table with somebody else in this room and now you're friends and it's beautiful. So let's do a little Q&A moments here. We're going to ask the question, what does eating with a glad and generous heart look like in its fullness to you? And a more introspective question, what might need to change in order to be in a physical and emotional position of being able to say, I've eagerly anticipated sharing this meal with you? Let's pray. Father, thanks for the beauty of the scriptures and the glimpses that you give us of your generous heartedness and desire to share the table with us. Let that pass from us to others, and give us the right things to take away and remember as we wrestle with the challenge to be people of the table as well as people of you. Amen.